This is supposed to be the Rose Christian Fellowship Summer School. I'd like to see them all over the country, that we would get together in all different parts of the country and do something like this. We started this under a retrograde Mercury, so that we do it again and again and again, I hope. So we're trying to focus exclusively or especially on the Rosicrucian philosophy, I thought I would do talks for the whole week on the most fundamental work of the Rosicrucian Fellowship. And I'm going to talk about, in the simplest way that I know how, there will be some complicated things, but they aren't essential. I'm going to try and talk about things in a way that we can all understand them or get a feel of them, even if we can't experience them directly. And I'm trying to keep everything within 1 hour, and I have 4 pages of notes. I limited myself to 4 pages of notes, so some people that I wrote so close to the bottom, it's unbelievable. So it's...
Both sides.
No, one side.
The title.
Single space.
The talk for today will start off very broadly and very generally. We'll try to get the big picture, and we'll try to get a cosmic scope of activity. And with that, we should have a broad perspective and a sense of proportion about things. Along with that will be a few little side trips into some of the basic things of our work. Now, the Rosicrucian Fellowship is an organization of Christian mystics. It is basically a spiritual service organization. The Rosicrucian Fellowship is intended serve the universal spirit. And it's intended to serve the individual foci of the universal spirit, that is, other humans. The source of the philosophy of the Rosicrucian Fellowship is the Rosicrucian Order. And that Rosicrucian Order is a group or a collection of very high initiates who are almost demigods compared to us. And they all have very well-trained, well-developed clairvoyance and spiritual powers. And they have formed the Rosicrucian Order to serve humanity at this time, especially the humanity that is too head-oriented and needs to follow its heart. We'll see more about that later. The Rosicrucian Order is an interworld order. In order to join the Rosicrucian Order, you have to be invited. And you have to be able to leave your body and to have sufficient soul power to attune yourself to the lofty teachings of that order. So the Rosicrucian Order is the source of the philosophy that is the Rosicrucian philosophy that we're going to be talking about. That philosophy is changed every century. As humans evolve and have more capacity to understand things, more of it can be disclosed. So that if you look at the Rosicrucian philosophy of 400 years ago or of 600 years ago, it is substantially different than it is now. It's not that the truths are different. It's that what could be said openly to people was different. The philosophy itself is a result of people working for many lifetimes very carefully, understanding the spiritual worlds in a manner that's similar to the way material scientists study the material world, trying to understand it, trying to record what is there, measure, do those sorts of things. And like material science, it's extremely well corroborated. It's not something that's subjective, saying somebody has an inner-world experience and says, I think it's all like this. It has to be substantiated, and somebody else has to be able to repeat your experiment, which is an experiment in consciousness and not in a laboratory, but it is very well checked out and put on very solid ground. Then the facts of reality have been organized, and they've been unified, and they've been synthesized into a whole that approximates and that parallels reality. A spiritual philosophy is not an end in itself. You can't live in a spiritual philosophy. The spiritual philosophy is there to point you to the reality. And the more invisible the philosophy is, and the more that it weans you from philosophical dependence so that you can see reality straightforward, the better the philosophy is. Now, the Rosicrucian philosophy is an evolutionary philosophy. And by evolution, several things are meant. It is a philosophy that is about an evolutionary creation. This means that we are participating in a divine creation, which in some respects is not different from an artistic creation of a human being. That there are things that are created for the beauty of it all. As an evolutionary philosophy, the Rosicrucian philosophy finds that there is a scheme, that there is a pattern, that there is a means that the evolutionary creation is fulfilled and that its objects and ends are fulfilled. As stated, the Rosicrucian philosophy is something like a superstructure for reality. It points to what is within and behind the outer side of things. Now, this evolutionary creation is designed to bring out definite spiritual powers in all of the beings that participate in it. We're going to be talking only about humans because that is most relevant or the most germane to what we're trying to do. But it's in the creation, everyone that participates is brought to develop, unfold, and create with spiritual powers just as the universal spirit as a whole does that with the whole of creation. So we're becoming divine beings within a divine being, and our divine being is not separate from that. We are expressions of it. It's a logical, timed sequence of events that is designed to build potentials, to unfold spiritual powers, and to bring them out in such a way that everyone can participate. It's glorious. Even in this physical outside of it, it's glorious to behold. I mean, that's really something wonderful. It's not something like a machine that grinds on. When you think of an evolutionary system that has aims and ends, it isn't like a machine that's grinding to an end and grinding out new souls. It's a creation that does have ends, but the ends are right within the means. It's very organic. The whole creation builds and develops as it goes along. And in all of this, it is scientific and it is creative in the sense that new things are discovered, not only by the participants, but by the universal spirit. This isn't an old hat repeated again and again and again for the universal spirit with nothing new. It's very much like Robert Frost, the poet, says, if there are no surprises for the poet, there are no surprises for the reader. And the surprise or the discovery aspect of it is probably one of the most wonderful part. So, this brings up questions like how much of the evolution is predetermined and how much is spontaneously creative, or how can things be new to the universal spirit? And those are all very engaging questions, and unfortunately they're way outside the bounds of these simple kinds of thoughts. So we'll have to pass on some of those things, and we'll have to look at more mundane examples, but even the mundane examples are not mundane. Probably the best examples are orchestral compositions. Even though the whole composition is scored, there's always room for the musician and for the conductor to do something interpretive, to do something new, or to find something new in that basic score. And in a lot of modern compositions, there's even room for a spontaneous improvisation. So it's something like that. There's always something new in any creation, artistic, scientific, or whatever. In science, the new has to deal with the unknown. Science has to do with discovery, working things over from this point of view and that point of view, until you discover something new. Sometimes you have to go through all kinds of drab statistics, just like we have to go through all kinds of drab exercises until we make a discovery of what we were talking about right before the break. Because of this, there is both creation and experimentation. A lot of what we call freak things in nature are really experiments that weren't too well conceived by the creator. And there's not much difference between genius and insanity, or between a special evolutionary advancement and some kind of freak. So because of the creativity and the experimental discovery, it is an evolutionary philosophy. But there's another way that it is evolutionary. It isn't just like a roadmap. It isn't like a maze or any superstructure like that. It isn't all worked out. If it was all worked out, we wouldn't even have to go through it. There would be no use to participate. And it's in this second sense of the word evolutionary that the philosophy and what it points to develops as it goes on. It's a growing kind of thing. But even the development is logical. whether we can understand it right now with our limited consciousness, there are principles within our very being and living, the way we participate in life, that indicate how we're going to unfold, and we discover those along the way. Rosicrucian philosophy is especially focused on a logical explanation. Doesn't mean have to be cut and dried like legalese, or it doesn't even have to be quite so limited as symbolical logic as far as the university, but that there is a meaningful rational understanding to everything. All right. First introduction is done. We're almost out of the first page already. Not too bad on time. There is an ancient Oriental maxim that goes something like this. The journey of 1,000 miles begins with the first step. Obviously, it intends to say, take action and don't think about the journey, or don't think about how long it is, or anything like that. You have to take the step of action before you do it. Now, the spirit of that could be carried out by modifying the maxim just a little bit. And you could say that the journey of 1,000 miles is accomplished in taking the next step. The first step is just the next one. And so that in taking the next step after the next step is how it is accomplished. This is the fundamental work of the Rosicrucian Fellowship in light of its philosophy and its relationship to the evolutionary creation. The fundamental work of the Rosicrucian Fellowship is to help humanity to take the next evolutionary step. So our fundamental work is to help humanity, ourselves included, to be able to take the next step. Yes, we will talk about far-fetched, large-scale evolution, as Earl did this morning, but the reason we exist as a group of people that work together spiritually is to help everyone take the next step evolutionary in evolution. The next step in evolution is building, organizing, and learning to use the soul body. That's why these talks are where they're designed. It is all about learning to build, organize, and use the soul body. And for the rest of the talk tonight, it's probably what all we're going to talk about. The Rosicrucian Fellowship does have other sub-purposes. It works as a preparatory school for the Rosicrucian Order. It provides a guaranteed path to a teacher with a capital T if you dedicate your life to service, and it provides exercises that are healthy and safe to get there. And that is one of the reasons for the Rosicrucian Fellowship. But the real reason, or the main reason for the Rosicrucian Fellowship, is to help humanity take the next step, which is to build the soul body. The Rosicrucian Fellowship exists as an organ to disseminate the sane and sound philosophical outlook of the Rosicrucians, Christian mysticism for Western people. That's another secondary thing. Christian mysticism brings one to a Christian mystical initiation, and that Christian mystical initiation is a microcosmic experience of the whole scheme of the evolutionary creation. Because we are a product of the evolutionary creation, and we are a miniature of it, and therefore, even in our individual advancement, we are like the universe. If one is taking an accelerated path in order to really be able to help by working very hard and giving all that one has, which is what the path of initiation is, before one can be initiated in this path, one has to have full working consciousness in the inner worlds, to be able to leave the body and function in the more divine realms. But before one can do that, one must have a sufficiently well-developed soul body. So whether we're seeking initiation or whether we're just taking the next step in evolution, because the Earth isn't going to be here as it is forever, and we're going to be functioning in a different realm, and we have to have the body for that realm. And that is what the Rosicrucian Fellowship is for. Because we are an organ of dissemination, it doesn't mean that we are indoctrinators. It is not anywhere in the intent of the Rosicrucian philosophy to indoctrinate. Because we are Christian mystics, and we know from the author of Christianity, you shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. If you know the truth of reality and that you are part of that truth, you are a creative free agent. And indoctrination only obscures that. Indoctrination is the form of mental enslavement. The next step is not part of a forced march. The next step is taken freely. And if anybody tries to indoctrinate and force you to take a step down a given path, that's not part of the intent. Each step is a step that is made in knowledge, and each step is a step that is made in freedom, and it's made in harmonious participation with every other living being. The purpose of the Rosicrucian Fellowship is not to provide extreme spiritual experiences for its students. We're not out to blow anybody's mind or to bliss anybody out. Yes, we do seek conscious union with the universal spirit, because God is what it's all about, and it can't be a philosophy that's based on anything real if that isn't central to it. Yes, we do seek all kinds of first-hand experience, because reading books or hearing anybody else is not knowing. It's hearing. It's a second-hand kind of experience. So the Rosicrucian philosophy helps develop people that are strong, that they can have self-control, self-conscious, spiritual world experience. But when that happens, when we do have transcendental spiritual experiences, or when we have clairvoyance of the psychic realms, or when we leave the body, it is not for those ends alone. The end is to help all of humanity take the next step. It's something like a jigsaw puzzle with one of the pieces missing. If you see this lovely thing that took a long time to put together, if there's a piece missing, it really bothers you psychologically. And any being that's participating that is not going to be able to take the next step, it's like a piece missing out of the puzzle. And it's like another viewpoint of the entire universe is lost, because each one of us is a living focus of some viewpoint. The Rosicrucian Fellowship always seeks to do all the work that it does in harmony with the teachings of Christ. Not necessarily any of the denominations or sects or anything like that, which are only mere shadows of what the real teaching of Christ is about, but that we try to do things as much as possible, as far as we understand the teachings of Christ. The Gospel of Christ gives two spiritual commandments. Given in Mark 12, verses 30 and 31, in the clearest statement, "Thou shalt love thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy mind, with all thy strength, and thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Not do unto others as you would have them do unto you." That's mild, that's weak. But to love your neighbor as you love yourself, that's heavy. So, this is precisely what we had in mind just a few seconds ago when we were talking about conscious union. It is love of the universal spirit in the most awakened way possible. The Gospel of Christ also gave us two functional commandments, and they are: preach the gospel and heal the sick. For us, as we understand it, preaching the gospel is interpreted as speaking the word, living in the living logos, the creative word, and living out and living with and living in the scheme of creation. Healing the sick is just another way of staying attuned to that word. And the next syllable of that word is living in the soul body. I'm being very repetitious on purpose because it's an important thing. The biblical Christ speaks, tells the story of those without wedding garments not being admitted to the wedding. And since the times of the alchemists, the soul body has been called the golden wedding garment. It is the garment in which the alchemical marriage is consummated. It is the necessary vehicle for the personality to be united consciously with the spirit, which is what the initiation or what the alchemical wedding is all about. So, the golden wedding garment is necessary for taking the next step. Now, that's not an arbitrary condition. If someone doesn't have that vehicle and hasn't developed the stuff for a theory of consciousness, you just can't be awake. You can't have the waking consciousness in the ethereal realm, which is where the next step is to. It's as simple as that. It's, I think every one of us has realized how thin our consciousness really is. It isn't thick, it isn't rich. Over years and years of working, it gets better, and we have a richer soul body on which the intuition can play, or within which we can project our imaginations, but right now it's pretty thin. And we have to be able to have that developed sufficiently so that we can leave our body and live in full consciousness. It isn't exclusively because of this, but we leave our body every night. But we're not aware of it because we don't wake up in the soil body. And part of that reason, part of the reason for that is that our soil bodies are not dense enough. There's not enough stuff in them. Now, we needn't be panicked, because almost everyone that is in the world right now will probably take the next step. And even if they don't, there will be future reincarnations of the earth in planes like this where it can be built. So if someone doesn't make it at when the earth dissolves this time, in one of the other three times that the earth is reborn, they will have ample opportunities. You know, this is not like a hellfire thing. You either make it now or you're damned, and you're for all of eternity, you're not going to be able to do anything. My hand. Oh, we're just going on. We're right in the middle of something, but that's all right. You may pick something up anyway.
May I listen to that?
What?
May I listen to that?
Sure. Not only should we not panic, and not only is it not an arbitrary thing, there is no limit. That there is no limit to how much gold you can put into the golden wedding garment. The only limit is how much we put ourselves forth in service and how well we do that service, which is what this whole series of talks is going to be about. That is the only limit. It's things in the spiritual worlds are very different than they are in the material worlds. In the material world, there's a limit to how fast you can run. Yes, we keep increasing it and increasing it and increasing it. The dash records, just this last month, somebody ran a 100-meter dash under 10 seconds. It's the first time that's ever happened. But those are incremental little things. As far as the development of soul for having rich, clear, inward consciousness, there is no limit. It's wide open. All right, now we've got a little bit of a grasp of the significance of taking the next step in a broad way, and now we can begin to be more specific. In fact, we're going to become more and more specific tomorrow night, and even more specific Wednesday and Thursday nights, and then we'll come back to a general statement toward the end of Friday night. So far, as we've looked at things, we've looked at just a general view. We've said that there is an evolutionary scheme to the creation in which we are participating, but we haven't said what it's about. And in order to do that, we have to look at it cosmographically. Now, cosmography, at least as we're going to talk about it now, we're going to go through it very fast because we're just trying to introduce a general idea. We're not trying to be really deep or anything like that. The purpose of this and the other presentations is to get a general picture of the cosmos so that we can see where the next step, where we're supposed to go next. It's like when you cross a creek. You know, there's a definite stone that you can step on to make the progress to get to the other side. So we want to look now and see definitely what the next step means. Now we're going to go into now in just a few minutes is something that we could go into for many talks over many years. In fact, I'm planning to do that. I realize that the clock is running out on me. I can understand in a spiritual sense the way a woman feels about her biological clock. That she says to herself, if I want to be procreative, I have to do it now because there's only going to be so much time that I can do so. And I'm beginning to understand that for myself, I don't think I'm going to be immortal in this body. That's a very slim possibility. And if I'm lucky, like my father is, I could have 20 years left. That would have to be awfully lucky. So what I'm thinking of doing is starting in the fall of 2005, I think I'm going to do classes year round, take a break every now and then to go to South America or something like that. But go year round because there's too much that I want to do. I feel full and I have to get it out. William Blake, who was a very creative poet, said about taking the next step, to become a star, you must shine where you are. A trip of 1,000 miles to the top of Mount Fuji not only begins with the first step, and each succeeding step thereafter, but it begins where you are. Some people never get out of their neighborhood. My father has a second wife, married a woman that when he married her, she was 70 years old and she had never been out of Wisconsin. She was filled with fear because her mother had committed suicide when she was about 9 or 10 years old, and she felt secure in the neighborhood. She never got out of the neighborhood. It was all she knew. The only way to know the rest of the world for such people is vicariously, through books, or movies, or television, or magazines, or maps, or things like that. In reality, in the cosmographical reality, that's the condition of almost everyone on Earth right now. We're stuck in the neighborhood. All we know is this. Matter. Dense matter. Gross matter. And to many people, this is all there is. There's nothing more than matter. Even for us, we who are supposed to know better, almost all of us, I know of myself because I don't conceive always in a living spirit, I have become so addicted to material perception that I'm a materialist. We conceive of things in forms of matter much more than we conceive of them in terms of spiritual life or in qualities of the spirit. We live not only materialistic lives, we live rather dull lives. It's really quite exciting to meet somebody who's unfolded spiritually. It's because they're alive in ways that, you know, like understanding someone that is quite spiritual is something much more exotic than going to the Amazon or someplace like that. But this is where we are, and this is where we begin. We have no choice but to begin here. Now, the Rosicrucian philosophy is a philosophy of the mysteries. And if we can be initiated by leaving our bodies and having the soul power to transform our character so that it is more attuned to the structure of the cosmic reality, that is all done. The trip that is taken, whether it is in our individual development or in the whole evolutionary scheme, is usually done both in large and in small. So cosmographically, we're going to look at our place in the cosmos, in the microcosm, in our little being, and in the greater cosmos. It's going to be very fast, it's going to be very thin, just to give you the idea. The reason it is done this way is because each of us is a miniature. The unity of the one is maintained by all of creation, especially vertically, as well as horizontally though, by the principle of analogy. That the unity that the great is like the smaller, like the smaller, like the smaller. It's called the Hermetic axiom, the principle of analogy. As above, so below. What has gone before in heaven will follow after on earth. Know this and rejoice. So, we begin with this. We have this formation, which is a dense physical body. Probably since our first cry in infancy, it has been an indubitable reality. Since we dwell already too much on the physical, we're going to speak very little about it, there are dense physical bodies are formations. They're formations that include solids, liquids, and gases. And different elements come and go from the formation, and even the formation itself metamorphizes and takes different shapes. So that if you see the formation when someone is young, they look different than from when they're older. Now, we're not going to say much about it because you can, there are plenty of physics books and chemistry books and anatomy books and physiology books and all of the other sciences that relate to the dense physical body that you can study, and they're a great joy to do. At least 3 or 4 days every week I study physiology. I'm fascinated by it. It's wondrous. You can't understand all of the things that take in our body. Comprehend all of those things that are going on, like our bodies are just a collective miracle for everything that goes on in them. Now, materialistic science says that this is all there is to a human. Materialistic scientists go to ingenious lengths to demonstrate that everything we experience is emotions, the thoughts, the ideas, everything that we experience is due to interactions of matter. And this is kind of an ironic assertion, and the ironic part about it is that when the materialistic scientist tries to demonstrate to you that you must agree with their arguments, they expect that you can agree with their arguments because you are a truth knower. And that you're a truth knower beyond the interactions of matter, because if the interactions of matter were different, the arguments would be different and the understanding of the arguments would be different. So in the very fact of making that kind of argument or that kind of assumption, it shows that they don't really believe in their own argument. There is something beyond the interactions of matter in our body, and that's proven even by material science. We, as an act of will, independent of our genetics, independent of what we had for breakfast, we can turn matter into energy. We haven't done much yet, except for magicians, of turning energy into matter, but we can do that. We can do it voluntarily, and we can predict how it's going to be and how much energy is going to be there. So we're more than just, we're outside of the system. We can use the system exactly the way we wish to, the materialistic system, that is. Materialistic science has an elaborate explanation for energy, and it's filled with all kinds of panoply of subatomic particles, bosons, and quarks, and things like that. And I've been a little bit ridiculous, I guess I shouldn't take that line. Mysticism also has a very elaborate view of energy, but it's not based on indirect and awkward experiments and statistical possibilities or statistical probabilities of something being some way. It is a matter of direct observation. This is what clairvoyance means, that we can directly see into nature, because we're part of the inner workings of nature. And anything that we're part of, we can perceive or apperceive, as the case may be. Now, mystics, such as the Rosicrucian seers, claim that interpenetrating the solids, the liquids, and the gases of the earth, there are other realms, more subtle, and the closest or the most like the solids, liquids, and gases are called etheric levels or etheric planes of existence. They are the stuff of energy, they are the stuff of life, and so on. In fact, the Rosicrucian philosophy claims that the etheric subdivision is really part of the dense physical plane. The chemical being one part, the etheric being another part, and it's subject to the same laws of nature. We're going to talk a little bit about that tomorrow when we go into detail and into the soul stuff itself. For now, let's see how this fits into the bigger picture. If we observe and contemplate our experience, our outward experience, we can see that etheric world of energy and vital life answers more to our experience than the chemical version that it's all chemical interactions. We can see that there is, to most of us now, an invisible energy that charges things and moves them around. We can see that plant and animal forms and human forms grow, and they have sentient life. And that isn't completely described by chemistry and matter. We can feel life in our own being, especially if we're very discriminating in our self-observation. We can recognize when we are vitalized and devitalized. However, if we look at that, that isn't enough to describe our experience either. If it were, we would all be just plants. We would vegetate, we would grow, and we would have a vital existence and nothing more. But if we look at the animals and at humans, we see that they can detach themselves from clinging to the earth, which the plants can't do, and which the minerals certainly can't do, because they are part of the earth itself, inseparable from it. Not only can we detach ourselves from the earth, but we can move around. But it's even more than that. We are motivated. Animals and humans are motivated to move. We all know from physics, if it were just a matter of physics, a body at rest tends to stay at rest until something moves it. And we know that even a sleeping dog will get up and run. It gets motivated, it has that in. Moreover, it's clear that animals and humans have a much greater spectrum than just motivation to motion. We have all kinds of feelings, emotions, and desires. Some of them, probably the greatest of them, like artistic desires or humanitarian desires, or things of that nature, are very far removed from chemical existence. They're made of a much different realm. There are poets and there are people who live in their feelings in such a way that they have an entire life that is composed exclusively of emotions. So, if we say this another way, we say that there is something in us that is beyond matter and energy that motivates us. Now again, for trained seers, for people who have done the great experiment and have used themselves as the laboratory and used themselves as the test tube, they have unfolded the ability to develop their feelings and emotions and motivations so perfectly that they can perceive emotions. It is a matter of clairvoyance. It is not a matter of speculation. It is not a matter of hearsay, because this talk is basically hearsay, because we're not all sitting here and following what is being said with an inner vision. And so in this regard, the Rosicrucian philosophy is developed by people who can see as accurately and proficiently and are well trained in seeing in the desire world, which is made up of emotions and feelings and passions and moods and things like that, with to the degree that we can in this physical world. And sometimes we're not even good observers in this world. So this is composed of desire stuff, which is altogether different than the dense physical world. The experience of emotions and desires are subject to different laws. The ethers are not. We'll talk about that scientifically tomorrow. The desire world is completely different in its composition. It's not made of matter as we know matter. And its laws are different. And in order to function in the desire world, you have to have experienced it long enough to have built the vehicle of desire. I'm going to move on. It's going a little too slowly. I'm supposed to be done just about now. It's fabulous, as all of this is, of understanding the laws of emotions, what attracts us to other people, what repulses us from them, and how we can affect things through emotion. And it's powerful, much more powerful than anything in the etheric or physical world. With the power of emotion, which is subtle, we can break anything in the physical world. There was a man that is a Wisconsin man, was a football player a few years ago, that he was in a Super Bowl, and his desire was so strong. He was a defensive lineman or linebacker or something, whatever it is. His desire was so strong to get at the opponents that by his desire, he snapped his leg. He put so much pressure on his leg that the physical body could not stand up to it. So, as powerful and subtle and wondrous as motivation and desire is, it still doesn't describe our experience. The Rosicrucian philosophy says that beyond the desire world is another realm. In this regard, humans have been called rational animals. That is, being capable of rational thought. We're not just creatures of desire. We're not emotional impulses. We can think things through. And the power of thought is still more subtle and greater than the power of desire. With our thoughts, we can control our desires in the same way that our desires can move the energies in us to move and cause changes in our physical body. You see, we're going deeper and deeper into our consciousness, and the deeper that we go, and it's something that we experience every day, the more subtle we are plumbing our depths, and the more subtle, the more powerful. The jump from desire to thought is as radical as the jump from the physical etheric to the desire world. It's a completely different world, completely different laws, completely different stuff. It's still analogously the universal spirit works through all of these different levels, and there is a unity that is maintained. Sometimes we find it us that our mind wants to do one thing and our desires want to do another thing. The body doesn't want to do anything at all, just wants to lay there and be tired. And but for the most part, that's because of it. We're not unified in our being. But for the most part, it's a unified thing from the spirit all the way down to our physical existence. So this is quite a big jump. Each of these vehicles is more powerful, and each is more subtle. Each requires a greater sensitivity and discrimination. Most people, it's kind of easy to respond to a desire impulse, especially if you're a sensualist or somebody like that. You can feel the desires, and people all around you can feel the desires going through you. But for some people, to be able to hear the thoughts and to know what you're thinking, and to even to get a, you know, it's tough getting control of a desire, but it's even tougher getting control of a thought, because it's so will-o'-the-wisp. It's like trying to grab a handful of water. It's subtle like that. In fact, even much more subtle than that. Within this realm of thought, the great seers, east and west, ancient and modern, find that there is a major division, just like there is a major division in the physical world. In the physical world, we have the completely outward solids, liquids, and gases as one part of it, and then we have the etheric region as the other part. The main divisions of the world of thought are like that. There are four regions of concrete thought and three regions of abstract or ideational thought. Everything from the concrete mind to our physical existence is called phenomenal. It is called concrete because it has a beginning, it has an end, and as subtle as thoughts are, they can be discreetly understood as objects in their own. Everything from the world of ideational thought into the realms of pure spirit is universal. Ideas are universal. Larger means larger, whether it is on earth or on whatever plane it is. So an idea is something that is completely universal. Not perfectly universal, but all ideas cover everything in the universe. But they still have some structure in them. For example, most ideas have the structure that can be stated in a formula, an abstract formula, like a physics formula, or a fairy tale, or something like that, where there is a relational association from different elements of reality. And that association between those different elements, even though the elements are spread universally, the moral of the story, or the structure of the story, is something that carries throughout the universe. This division between the abstract and the transcendental realms that go beyond, that are universal, and the phenomenal realms is a major watershed in reality. They're two very greatly distinctive kinds of existence, concrete existence and abstract or universal existence. Now, just as everything in this world has to be made of solids, liquids, or gases, everything that is in the world of ideational thought has to be an idea. And there is one idea that to us is of central importance. All ideas are universal, and even though they have limitations inside of them, they're universal. Mathematical ideas, ideas of life, ideas of feeling. The idea that we want to get to is a divinely conceived idea. It is a divinely conceived idea of the divine. The idea of the spirit made tangible, I can't say tangible, but condensed, that's not even the right word, objectified. The spirit objectified as an idea of spirit. You know what we're trying to get at here? That idea is the idea of self. That is the idea of universal spirit as God. Not with a beard or anything like that, but as an objectified focus. And it is the universal idea of self as God. This is a very central thing to everything else. We can even get at it from the Bible. We can vector from two statements in the Bible and come to the same thing. One statement is, humans are created in the image of God. Another one is, God is a spirit and must be worshipped in spirit. And as a consequence, we are images of spirit. And that image is not like a visual image, it is an idea. It is like the spirit of being conceiving an idea of its being objectified as a self. Of course, the magnitude and the centrality between God the One and God as each of us is tremendously different. But that is what we're trying to get at. This self in Christian mysticism is called the human spirit. It is a focus on the truth of being that is the universal spirit. It is the thinker. Therefore, when I'm trying to address people like you, or you address each other, you recognize that there is a universal spirit that is shared by each of us, and that when we address each other, we're not addressing a body, we're addressing a focus of that spirit, and each of us has a unique viewpoint in that because of our different experiences and just because of our different state of existence in different places, so to speak. That when we are addressing each other, it is God talking to God, and we realize that there is something inside that can understand because it's part of the same truth. Sometimes this is called the spiritual ego with a capital E, not to be confused with a pseudo-ego that is a lower nature that we have. And it is what moves us. It is what thinks the thoughts that clothe themselves in motivation, that cause the desire, that cause the energy to move us physically or even to just think a thought. It is this knower, this divine focus that is the purposeful part of us in our being. This means that each and every one of us can know the truth. Right now, we may have all kinds of illusions, and we may be caught up in materialistic sense illusions, or we may have personal subjective desires that bias us, but there is no reason why each and every one of us should not be able to clearly see the truth. And we have to respect this in each other being. If we don't, we're not respecting ourselves. Because what we are is just another focus. I shouldn't say just another focus, because each one is really divine. Now, this divinely conceived idea that is the self is subject to the principles of mediation. Now, it's a mathematical truth, and you can state it mathematically, that if you take something that is completely amorphous and you wish to objectify it, that is to even have an idea of it. The simplest objectification of anything in all amorphous being or potential being is a triangle. In any number of dimensions, from 1 to n, the simplest objective being is a triangle. Of course, this is a very gross triangle because it's made with chalk. The triangle that is the idea is just the conception of being able to take the potential of space and have an amorphous spirit objectify itself by having three different phases or three different facets or three different lines or whatever. This is why in all forms of mysticism, from China to Native Americans, the objectification that is a self is a focus of three abstract attributes that are called a threefold spirit. This is what, so it's a focus of something that goes beyond the idea. The understanding of things beyond the idea, it's direct, immediate knowing, just like when you get an intuition that you know something the truth, you don't have any idea why. But when it gets objectified, it is objectified by reflection. By reflecting through ideas is the way the spirit knows itself. And when those ideas are projected into phenomenal realms, the objectification is more complete, and the knowing of spirit and of its creative being is that much greater. The life spirit transcends the human spirit. And if the human spirit is self, selfness is what the life spirit is all about. If the human spirit is ideas, the one truth that transcends all of those ideas is what the life spirit is about. Therefore, if one experiences one's being in life spirit, one is automatically an altruist and loves everyone else because you're in the universal selfness. Yourself is no different than any others. It's a commonly shared spirit. Beyond this is what is called divine spirit, the first of the three attributes of spirit. They're given in many different ways in many different cultures. All seers find the same thing in this regard, which is basically the will to be. You can't say much more than that, because if it were to have more attributes to itself, then it wouldn't have the unity that it has. And that's way beyond what we want to talk about. All right. Now we have a rough idea of what we are. We are a spiritual foci. That is ones, selves, individuals who have come to, or are coming to, wicked self-knowledge of the universal spirit shared by all. And that as human beings, this spirit is focused through the mind, through the emotions, through the etheric being, and into the physical. And when we're wakingly conscious here, when we're wakingly self-conscious, which the greatest self-consciousness is being able to appreciate the glory of the world outside and around us, we are, the spirit is seeing itself in its most simplified way possible. So, we now have a rough idea of a what our focus is. We are evolutionary beginners in this dense physical world. The limits here are so great because it's sort of like when you learn music. You know, you don't learn to start out with 12-tone music. You start out with a little mode, and you learn to play simple melodies and simple rhythms. And then as you graduate, you get more and more complex, and you have more things available to you, until at last you can become free form with just about anything and bring cosmos out of chaos. So we are about ready to graduate, to have our consciousness expanded, because we've gone as far as we can go. And in a way, we've gone as far, if I might say it without sounding blasphemous, we've gone as far as God can go. All of us in this room have practiced for many years trying to develop control of our concentrated spiritual focus. Sometimes we can hold an image in our consciousness and hold it for a few seconds. And when we do, we can see through and we can get all kinds of understandings. But this solid earth is the deepest manifest concentration of God. And it may exist billions of years, but to sustain this level of density, even God has limits in that. And it's unnecessary to stay with this many limits. And so what we've been trying to say all night is that we are ready to graduate. We're ready to take the next step of evolution. And the next step of evolution requires that we have developed the etheric consciousness so that we can leave the physical behind and function in the much different etheric sub-realm of this physical world, which is radically different, that's to say nothing of even higher states of consciousness. And that is what the primary work is that we work together to help humanity to do. Now all the rest of the talks are going to be directed primarily to that work. Let's make some crummy diagrams first. We'll do the microcosm and macrocosm. I'm not putting myself in a right brain mode. This is a human, sort of. This is the dense physical body of a human. It's a hippie, we don't know whether it's male or female. And to the clairvoyant experience, this physical body is suspended. In an energy vehicle that interpenetrates every atom, every molecule, every cell of the physical, and extends a little beyond it. So we are floating within life and energy. Because the life and energy are subject to gravitation, it feels like we're held down to the earth. In fact, when you leave your body, one of the first things you have to learn to do is learn to live with weightlessness. Because you're not that subject to gravity anymore, and it feels like you're falling all the time. Terrifying, takes a long time. This physical etheric is suspended in an auric vehicle made of desire material. And to one who can see with the eye of feeling, everything that a person is repressing, everything that a person is about to feel, everything that a person is feeling is in this aura of desire material. In part of it, we're just beginning to develop a mind made of mind stuff which relates us to the world of thought. And that mind is the link to the spirit that is the truth and that is the truth knower. You can't even draw a picture of the threefold spirit because it's universal. In another way, we can say the same thing. This is the earth, solid, and it is suspended in ethers that extend hundreds of miles out into space. And when the whole world is floating in a realm of energy, which is interpenetrated and surrounded by a desire aura, which stretches several planets either way in the solar system, if you're thinking in terms of three-dimensional space. But all of the higher vehicles are within. This is in turn suspended within the world of thought, which runs the extent of the solar system. It's again subtle, it's right within. Some people describe the different kinds of experience that you focus on the reality of something with your consciousness and it opens up, and that within and behind it is another realm, and then within and behind that. It's like one of those things where you open up a little surprise box and then there's another surprise in it, and it's like that in consciousness. The life spirit, I don't even want to try drawing it. It's, you know, I don't want to give you a materialistic conception of it. But spatially, it covers beyond the solar system, the fringes of the solar system, and divine spirit extends to other stars. Now, this all sounds like science fiction. I'm just saying these things to introduce you to the notions, but I'm not trying to be persuasive about it. The earlier things that we did were things that we can get from our experience. We can experience our physical nature. You know, it's a limited experience. There have been three times in life that I've walked into lampposts. And then they improved with the reality. Yeah, I was a drinking kid, you know. Why? I really wake up when that happened. And you can experience life and vitality. I can tell the difference. I eat a lot of raw vegetable juice and I draw the energy off of the raw, fresh vegetables, and I can feel it in my body. All of these things are things we can experience. Now we understand that we're going to leave this behind at least for a few millions or billions of years, and we, in order to take the next step in evolution, we have to have the stuff of consciousness for consciousness to play on when we are out of this world and in the next more subtle realm. And that is our work, to develop ourselves and to help other people to develop that soul body. All right. We'll close with the Rosicrucian prayer. Oh God, increase our love for thee, so that we may serve thee better.